The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thank you, Rebecca. This sounds like, you know, reading your rights before the interrogation. Good morning to you all, and thanks for coming at this early hour and that for this last minute addition to the program, actually, also. Let me start by reading from the comment of one of those lunatic sects that keep bashing many of us here. The ISO is a main target of these guys, and me personally have had a lot of flack from them. So they commented on socialism, and well, you know, taking the list of speakers and seeing among us many agents of imperialism, you know, things like that, supporters of imperialism. But the funny thing is that they say about me, based upon his well-documented statements in support of imperialist intervention in the Middle East, Ashkar, whose scheduled talk at the conference is entitled, "Is Karl Marx Relevant to the Middle East?" would have to answer no if he had any intention of being honest about his own perspective. So they want me to answer no, but of course I won't. And as you may guess or expect, my answer is very different from what they want me to say, and that is by being very honest. So what I'll be discussing is the analytical tools that you can find in Marxism with regard to the Middle East. And that's, of course, not something to be taken for granted, because, I mean, if you are Marxist, and I presume that there are a number of you in this room, you believe that it's a universally valid method of understanding history, society, and the rest. You don't put regional limitations. But if we go out of our own circle of co-thinkers, the perspective is indeed quite different, and you have a huge lot of people who of course, in the first place, you have a big lot of people who like this border agent at my entrance here told me when I said I was going to socialism, he said that would be a tough sell for him. That's a general perspective, but when it comes to the regional view of that, you will hear a lot of views stating that, well, Marxism is okay for Western societies. It's valid for Western societies, that Marx is a Western thinker, basically. And that's not valid for, and then you name it, cultural areas that are not Western, that are different. And that would mostly be with regard to Oriental, between quote marks, societies, societies to the east of Europe and the east of the Mediterranean, south and east of the Mediterranean. And that's indeed where probably the validity of Marxism has been most disputed in cultural terms. And an important, significant part of that is the debate about Orientalism. Orientalism, as you may know, refers to a specific brand of what we could call essentialism applied to the Orient. And especially the Islamic countries, the Middle East as a broader region, And this essentialism, which also can apply to any other cultural area, the South Asia, of course, or East Asia, for instance, or sub-Saharan Africa, regards societies as basically determined by their cultural patterns, and therefore understands history as determined by the same cultural pattern. That's a certain way of reading history as something that is determined by culture. And that's why it's an essentialism, because it regards various cultures as representing a kind of perennial essences that would determine the fate of their populations. And when you put it that way, for someone who is used or who's familiar with Marxism, you would immediately think of what Marxism criticizes in the first place as being an idealist conception of history, as contrasting with the materialist interpretation of history that is at the basis of Marxism, what we call Marxism, the famous historical materialism. That is the central component of the Marxist reading of history and the present. And therefore, you already here have a clue to the fact that, in fact, the accusation that Marxism is Orientalist is somewhat contradictory with the very essence, if you want, in that we are speaking here of a method of Marxism. We can find the Oriental, the essentialist, more generally, perspective very much so in the philosopher that Marx and Engels referred to as the kind of contrary view of history than compared to theirs, which is Hegel, where we find very much this view of history as determined by cultures, and these cultures being determined mostly by religions, and that's you can see that this is a very old perspective. It's much older than Hegel, of course, but Hegel is the main, probably the main representative of this kind of view. And Marx and Engels' views were started as a critique of this kind of perspective, and hence it's not surprising in the least that the key inspirations of the man who made Orientalism as a term a pejorative, exclusively pejorative term in wide circulation, and here I'm referring to Edward Said in his book of bearing the same title, which came out in the late 70s. The main inspirations of Said were Marxist, actually. The people he referred to are Marxist thinkers, like Anwar Abdel Malik, his main, from whom he took the key ideas of what is central in his critique of Orientalism, but also praising people like Maxime Robinson or Claude Ken or others who were all Marxist scholars of Islam and its history and the Arab countries and the rest. And yet, rather than acknowledging his debt to Marxism through these authors, Said included Marx among the Orientalists. In his list of 19th century Orientalists, Marx is there prominently, and that was seized by a whole number of people, including in what's called postcolonial studies and the rest, all this legacy of Edward Said, in dismissing Marxism for that reason. And Said did so on the basis of actually one single article of Marx on India in 1853. You can find detailed discussion of these matters in this book published by Haymarket, so I can do some advertisement here. And there is also a misreading of what Marx was saying at that time. It's a famous document by Marx, a famous article in which he discusses British rule in India. And although the terms show quite a clear empathy by Marx with the Indian people against British imperialism, so the empathy is very clear, but nevertheless, Marx shows a kind of belief in the fact that despite all the horrors of British imperialism, in fact, the social structures that are in India are the basis of some historical stagnation, as he would see it, and that England, in disrupting this whole system, is actually, as he put it at the end, the unconscious tool of history in bringing about that social revolution. Okay, and so you end up by a view of the positive role of imperialism, which actually you'll find later in some much later Marxism debates, like Bill Warren, for instance, to give a name of someone who tried to start from this positive view of the role of imperialism. Now, first of all, the first comment on that is that it's not an Orientalist view of what's in India. It's not that Marx is explaining or restricting India's history to the culture. In that article, he was locating the root of the stagnation, as he would see it, wrongly, but that's a different discussion, of India in the social structure. And therefore, the positive role of England is not cultural in that sense, it's social. It's in disrupting a social structure. And that's very different from essentialism. The belief that if you disrupt the social structure, India can, you know, be on the path of capitalist development and all that is actually contrary to an essentialist view that would postulate that that's not possible because of their culture. And that's the point here that he Said did not get. So you have actually Marx revised his own views actually on that later on, and he better understood that. I may come back to that, the role of imperialism. But what remains true is that Marx in 1853 in particular was very much limited by the horizon, the intellectual horizon of his time, what was available to him, and also the whatever revolutionary thinker one may be, you're still limited by the knowledge of your time, and there's always some influence of the dominant kind of perspectives, and we can find what is a Eurocentric perspective in Marx at this moment in time, and also a kind of rather naive, if we judge it today, view of historical development as, you know, unilinear and going in the direction of progress. You know, that's the perspective, what you could call in philosophical term, for anyone interested, a positivist view of history. So that was very much in the spirit of the time, of his time. The truth is that his merit would be later on in separating himself from this perspective, in going beyond that perspective. He didn't last long. It didn't take him too many years to understand that that wasn't really the case, and I'll get back to that. So that was the issue, and that issue was not for him a matter restricted to Oriental or whatever cultures that applied to Europe itself. The terms that Marx has on Europe's agrarian past are not very kind. The terms he has about the peasantry and all that are far from being nice. And the way he depicts bourgeoisie, the role of the bourgeoisie in the Communist Manifesto, which has been very much praised as a definitely a fantastic book from several aspects, but I think many people tend to overlook the flaws in the analysis that is in the Communist Manifesto. This big praise of the role, the fantastic progressive role of the bourgeoisie, misses a major dimension of that role when it comes to the structuration of the world, if you want, and the fate of that major part of humanity that was not at the core of this development that he praises in such terms in the manifesto, Marx and Engels. The idea that the bourgeoisie is creating, to quote the term, a world after its own image is quite wrong. That was based on the view that the bourgeoisie is spreading its civilization, that's the terms he used, to all barbarian nations and peasants and all that. Well, no. The mode of production, the capitalist mode of production, was being spread, but in a very distorted form in most of the world, actually, and creating impediments to the development of the rest of the world. That the early Marx, the early Marx and Engels, did not understand. It took them some time to get to that. I discussed this in details in that little book. The example of Ireland was determinant in their understanding that imperial domination can actually suffocate countries and block their development instead of this rosy picture that you find in the Communist Manifesto. So basically, the point remains, to get back to my starting point, that the materialist interpretation of history is the only, I would say, the main, but I would say even the only radical antidote to essentialism, precisely because it regards culture and all that as determined by the material conditions, and therefore as in flux, as something that can change with the change in the material conditions, not as some perennial essence that imposes itself on the long march of history, as you would find in Hegel that I mentioned. That's the first major point to say about this issue. We can see, therefore, here how Marx is not only relevant, but crucial in combating these views, these very biased views of the Middle East, to get back to my topic, which I'm mainly concerned here with the Middle East, but that applies to other areas. Now, if you get that perspective, then, and that's what Marx and Engels will understand later on, as I said, just a few years after that, in the late 50s, they had the late 50s of the 19th century, of course, they had come to that understanding of the global power structure and the global structure of capitalism as a hierarchy, but one which also impedes the development of the periphery, if you want, compared to the core of the system. Now, if you get to that, then you get to the role of what we would call in later terms, compared to Marx and Engels, imperialism, and all the theories and discussions of imperialism. So that's a major issue here, because in any analysis of Middle East, or for that matter, any of the other areas of the global periphery of the capitalist system, this is crucial also to understand all the problems that this relation and this structure created. And as I said, in after the late 50s. This perspective is very clear in Marx, and in his volume 1 of Capital. The volume 1 of Capital ends, I mean, the last chapters very much point to this plunder of the rest of the world on which the primitive accumulation of capital was based. And he depicts that in terrible terms, but the reality is much more terrible, as we know. But that shows that indeed, in developing the capitalism in the core, this development of capitalism in the core was based on the impoverishment, the plunder of the periphery, and that's very crucial in understanding, including the history of the Middle East, where, for instance, you had in 19th century an early developmental capitalist project in a country like Egypt, for instance, that was blocked by British imperialism, and there you can point to that. So we can point to many historical examples where imperialism prevented actually the capitalist development of major areas of the periphery. Practically all the non-Western world was Western, including the European offshoots like the United States and Australia and the rest. But aside from that, all the rest of the world was under this kind of blockage, maybe with the exception of Japan because of its very specific conditions of insularity. And therefore, that's an exception confirming the rule rather than anything looking like a rule. Now, in connection to that, and to this major clue in understanding the problems of development of the Middle East as one area concerned by that, you have a corollary question in the issue of the persistence of archaic, what I could call archaic social features, especially in some part of the Middle East, especially in the most in the oil regions of the Middle East, especially in the Gulf, where you can see this very obvious persistence of tribalism, very crude patriarchalism. A lot of pre-capitalist and pre-industrial features remaining and playing a prominent role. And there this brings us back to this issue of culture. Is it a matter of culture, as the Orientalist perspective would put it, that this remains or not? And here again, the Marxist perspective is crucial in undermining, in refuting the view that that's because of culture. Because it will push you to see why these features were maintained, and actually even in the history of imperialism, why did imperialism change, try to create a world after its own image in some countries, that includes even India, parts of Africa and all that, where the British, for instance, take British imperialism, you can say the same about others, but British imperialism in particular reproduced its own political system in many countries. Judicial, political, all the rest. You have clones of Britain, of British institutions in many countries. Not there. Huh. Why the same imperialism did not do repeat that there? And there we get to their role actually in preserving these features and cultivating them. And that's because of the resources of these areas that they wanted to exploit. Especially that they're consolidated, their control there, the most direct one in the early 20th century, when oil had become a major resource for the economy and including for the imperial project, for the military and the rest. So that's that brings us to the issue of combined development, which we find already in Marx, especially his comments, for instance, on Russia, on the contemporaneity of modes of production of societies. That is, with the creation of a global market and the global interaction, the development in the core countries affects all other countries, but leads to combined features. Like you had in Russia already in Marx's time, and even more so in the early 20th century, Russia combined pre-capitalist features in most of its agrarian, mostly agrarian economy still, and very advanced kind of industrial concentration in its industrial centers. And this combination, which is at the core of Trotsky's famous analysis and his concept of uneven and combined development, is a view that is already in Marx and is also a very important analytical tool when facing all these issues. And this also can bring us to the role of the United States. I've spoken of British imperialism, but the relation between the United States and the most archaic, patriarchal, anti-women, anti-democratic state on earth, the Saudi Kingdom, which is the main Middle East client of the United States, is absolutely striking. Here again, compare what the United States did in the Philippines, or you know, wherever you want, in exporting, also in trying to clone its institutions at some point, and what they did there, where they preserved very much so this extremely reactionary kind of system that was brought, actually it's not even a cultural feature, that was brought by a conquering force to that part of Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, and that was cultivated by the United States, very much encouraged, you know, in keeping that. And the United States built an enclave in that country, which was a kind of state in the state, the Aramco, the Arab American, Arabian American oil company, which was Arabian only geographically, but in terms of ownership, it was purely American. And that was a complete enclave in that country. So that's quite important in understanding the region, because again, you will find so many, I mean, the Orientalist trope on a country like the Saudi Kingdom is so much current, so much prevalent, that it's a very good reminder, actually, to keep this materialist perspective and to understand, and that's the best refutation, that what the Orientalist perspective regards as the major flows, if you want, of this Oriental culture, are actually something that was preserved, cultivated, and used by Western imperialism. And there, it's a complete reversal of perspective that you get into. And that's a major contribution of the materialist perspective of Marxism. Another major concept in that regard is that of Bonapartism, which was based mostly on those countries catching up with the capitalist development of the most advanced, especially Britain, on the background of agrarian societies still mired in pre-capitalist features, like France and Germany. And these historical experiences produced what Marx called, with reference to France, Bonapartism, and you had some kind of equivalent in Germany with Bismarck, at the same time as you had Napoleon III, the one who inspired Marx's book, the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, which is the major work in which Marx analyzes this, but you find also in other works, including Civil War in France at the end of the Second Empire, of the rule of Bonaparte, Louis Bonaparte, this concept actually proves as a major clue for 20th century Middle East. This concept of based on 19th century Europe is much less relevant to 20th century Europe than it is to 20th century Middle East because of these conditions of late capitalist, of capitalist development in societies that were not. And this contemporaneity of the British model with the less or the more, the less advanced economically Germany and France, you will find on a more global level rather than the European one between the core capitalist countries and the Middle East, and that's a clue to understanding that how this pattern that Marx described as Bonapartism, where the executive and often the armed forces seize upon themselves this task of modernization and industrialization of their societies. And can force that through. This pattern is almost, you know, pervasive in the 20th century Middle East. That starts with Turkey. I mean, I'm here taking Middle East in the broad sense, where after the First World War, you have a Bonapartist regime based on military leadership, originating in the military and embarking on this a project that is quite similar in essence to that of Louis Bonaparte or a mixture of the first and the second Bonaparte modernizing and industrializing their countries. And then in the post Second World War, this pattern that is after the end of direct colonial rule, you will see this pattern expand to cover many countries of the Middle East. Egypt will be the model and a model inspired by the Turkish experience, but going behind beyond it because also of historical circumstances and the connection with the Soviet Union of that time. So you have another source of inspiration, which was already for the Turkish case an inspiration because Mustafa Kemal in Turkey imitated or imported some of the features of the Soviet model, like the five-year plan and the rest. That was much more the case in the Nasserist model that went beyond the issue of political a monopoly of power into even substituting the state, the public sector, that is, to a non-existing national private capitalism in trying to modernize and industrialize their countries. And so it's really pervasive. That is the Egyptian model. You'll find it reproduced in variants, but essentially the same in Algeria, in Iraq, in Syria. That's already quite a number of major countries of the region with influences on the rest. So that's another major analytical tool that Marxism and Marx provide for the understanding of the Middle East. And I would say that's very crucial in understanding modern Middle East history. Now, in this respect, we find the role, a specific role of petit bourgeois layers or groups or factions. In this historical development in the Middle East. Those nationalist experiences which led to Bonapartist regimes were based to a major extent on petit bourgeois layers of society. And here we have also a clue when we connect that to the perspective of Marx and Engels after the 1848 revolution in Europe, about the role of the petit bourgeois democrats and the rest, as they would call them. There will be this understanding of of the role of the petite bourgeoisie, which is not in the Communist Manifesto. That comes later again. So you see, the Communist Manifesto is not this just summary of what Marxism becomes later. It's a crude early version of the views of Marx and Engels. But what we find in Communist Manifesto, where this aspect of the role of the petite bourgeoisie is not really present, we have this famous insight about the petite bourgeoisie, the petit bourgeois, as having only two paths, one being that joining the proletariat, so that there's, as I said, no understanding of that specific role of the petite bourgeoisie as such, that they can have their own democratic nationalist perspective. But the other is in trying to preserve their social status against capitalist development, the other being trying to turn back the wheel of history, as he puts it. And that provides a key clue. For my case, I've been using that for decades now, this basic clue of Marx and Engels and the Communist Manifesto as a major clue, a major insight in understanding the nature of Islamic fundamentalism, which is exactly an attempt ideologically to turn back the wheel of history, to return to some kind of utopian, mythical early age of Islam. We have to re-imitate all that, and once we imitate all that, we'll get back to the golden age of our history. So there, this kind of nostalgia and all that, we have an excellent departing point, an excellent clue in analyzing it in this well-known observation by Marx and Engels. And in the same respect here, we when we understand the role of these ideologies, we can also understand how they were used, and here I get back to what I was saying about Western imperialism. They were used by Western imperialism. I mean, the crudest possible interpretations of Islam were used by Western imperialism, and above all, this country, in fighting anything more or less on the left in the Middle East and beyond, in the world of Islam. This use of Islamic, which is again a major refutation of the kind of Orientalist perspective. Take one example for this country, which is crucial. Iraq was regarded, that's always exaggerated, but was regarded as one of the most secular countries of the Middle East, under the Baathist rule. And indeed, the Baath is a secular party. It's not a religious party. Hence also the contradictions in the alliance between Iran and Iran on the ground and the Baathist regime in Syria. But when invading Iraq, the United States brought with it the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, the Dawa Party, and the Islamic Party. And these became the major, plus if you can add to them one secular guy who's a former CIA asset, Eyal Alawi, but the bulk of these guys were Islamic fundamentalist forces. One of them Sunni Muslim Brotherhood, and the others Shia, very narrowly connected to Iran. And that will plant the seeds of the later fall of Iraq under Iranian domination, which is the major aspect of this big defeat or disaster that the occupation of Iraq has become from the point of view of U.S. imperialist interest, and compared to the U.S. imperialist project of those behind this, the project for a new American century, and the rest, the whole bunch of people around the George W. Bush administration. two very quickly because I don't have time, but anyhow, what this talk is based on a contribution that I wrote for the Oxford Handbook on Marxism, which will be coming out later this year. This is the year of the bicentenary of Marx, so you have I've been asked by both Cambridge University Press and Oxford University Press to contribute to books on Marxism, you know, Marx and all that, so that's fine. The Marx's analysis of rent and the rentier behavior is very important, again, in understanding all these rentier economies. And rentier states, most importantly than rentier economies, that we have in the Middle East, and the way the rentier perspective informs their economic behavior, including their investments abroad, including everything, their pattern of behavior in speculative forms, and seeking rents, like through portfolio investments and the rest, seeking rents rather than capitalist profits in a dynamic sense, that is, of enterprise. And that's very important. Also, in understanding, you can find in Marx, in Capital, in volume 3 and the rest, you find clues about the role of this rentier money in what he calls in leading to, speaking in his time, stock exchange gambling and modern bankocracy. And that's very much in the neoliberal age, we have come back fully to this kind of economy that Marx was depicting. And the last point, and not the least, is that Marx's theory of revolution is absolutely fundamental to understand the what was called the Arab Spring, which I regard as just the starting phase of a protracted, long-term revolutionary process. This will be the topic, I mean, we'll discuss this and the present conditions later today, because I'm due to give a second talk on this same day. That's how it was scheduled, not my fault. But the key point here I want to say is that Marx's theory of revolution, social revolution, as resulting from the clash between the development of productive forces and relations of production that are blocking this development, is fundamental to understanding the explosion of the Arab countries. You know, it's absolutely fundamental, because we have had a certain type, a certain modality of capitalism. One aspect of which is this rentierism, the other aspect of which is the degrees of patrimonialism, that is, and there we must borrow from other than Marx, because on this issue he didn't develop much, the patterns of state, the political typology. But this combination of rentierism and various degrees of privatization of the state, of private ownership of the state, lead to a blockage, historical blockage, in which the development of productive forces was very much blocked. And the major aspect of that is the massive underemployment of human resources, this huge, gigantic unemployment, and especially of the youth, and the underemployment of the rest, whether in the form of informal activities, as they are called, or just by refraining from working, because there is no horizon for that. So this aspect is central. I have used very much that. I put that even as the epigraph of my book, The People Want, in which I provide my analysis of this big explosion. The Marxist perspective is absolutely central to what I tried to do, and I believe that it is central to any serious analysis and understanding of what has been happening. And I will stop here, and thank you for listening. ¶¶
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.